White Rocket Entertainment.
I'm Van Allen Plexico of the AU Wishbone. In the series beginning with this episode, John Ringer and I will take you through the entire modern history of Auburn football and explore what it's been like to be a member of the Auburn family during those years. In these episodes, you will hear from a number of members of the Auburn family, including members of our own families, as we try to discover exactly what it means to be an Auburn person with all that that entails. I've always described being a member of the Auburn family as riding the roller coaster with all the great highs and terrible lows that that entails. But through it all, one thing has kept us and sustained us, and that's summed up in part of the Auburn Creed. I believe in Auburn and love it. This is We Believed.
This is We Believed. A Lifetime in the Auburn Family. Part 1, 60 Minutes, Shug to Barfield to Die, 1975 through 1981.
Third and 14 from the 38. Late in the game, screen over to McIntyre, but it's broken up, incomplete.
Oh, well, they smelled that out real good and covered it extremely well.
That essentially was the end of the game. Alabama got one more possession and moved down to the one-yard line, and there's the meeting at midfield between Coach Durden and Bryant as Coach Durden ends his coaching career at Auburn University. Final score in the final game, Alabama 28, Auburn nothing.
John and I are about the same age, and we grew up as Auburn fans from pretty much birth. That's true for you too, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. There was never a time when you stopped and said, okay, what college football program or whatever am I going to be for? I mean, it was already written into your programming code at the base level in your OS, right?
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of variance from that.
Yeah, it wasn't really optional. I grew up in Sylacauga, about 45 minutes south of Birmingham on the highway that runs down to Auburn. So, you know, I was like ground zero right between the poles there. And my high school, Sylacauga, wore red. And the coaches and the teachers all went to Alabama and would go to Alabama every Friday afternoon for the weekend for games in Birmingham or Tuscaloosa. Our marching band was called the Half Million Dollar Band, and we played in Legion Stadium in Sylacauga. Okay, so this gives you a sense of of what Sylacauga's like. Of course, more of my classmates ended up going to Auburn than Alabama. That was usually the case back then. It was a bigger school back then, but I can remember being like in kindergarten and somebody gave me a hand-me-down navy blue nylon jacket. I mean, it was like a slick, almost raincoat plastic nylon navy blue jacket. And the only thing on it, because this was like the early 70s, the only thing on it was on the lapel, like on the breast, like pocket area, was an orange, just block letters, Auburn. You know, today they wouldn't even sell that. It'd be too boring. They'd have like the AU and there'd be orange stripes and be all, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it was just a plain blue jacket and it said Auburn on the lapel. And this was one of my most cherished belongings. I clung to it. I loved it. I held on to it. And I remember like on a Halloween, right after I got it, standing in line for a haunted house in Sylacauga with my sister and some other people. And I remember looking down at my jacket and thinking, you know, I love this jacket. And I remember thinking, so does that mean I'm an Auburn fan? I guess it does. And that was the last time I ever thought about it. until maybe 2003, but we'll get to that later. I'm just kidding. That was the season I wore black to some of the games. So I wanted to ask John about what it was like to grow up an Auburn person in Georgia. But first, I got to thinking, why do we even care? Why does it matter to us? Why does it get our hearts pumping so fast and so hard on a Saturday afternoon? Why does it become the thing that dominates our conversations for months at a time, if not the entire year? Why does football matter so much, particularly to Auburn people? So I asked Jeremy Henderson of the WarEagleReader.com.
I mean, everything about it's this just martial metaphor, you know, even with all the language that's used and just being this, I don't know, heroic effort just to move the ball, you know, 10 yards. There's just this heroic aspect of it, you know, of taking land and moving in one purpose, you know, toward a goal. I'm very much deep in research on the earliest days of when it really became like a national craze. And it was just something about it in Americans that seemed to, because the physicality of it really was constantly the science of it compared to, I guess, everything that was out there at the time. And I'm talking like in the 1890s. And it just seemed to really like strike a chord, you know, like on campuses, because it was just so much more of a spectacle to watch. I mean, from the pace of it to the violence, the team aspect of it. And so to answer your question, I have no idea. I don't know what it is, but it gives me chills. So I just go with it.
We all do, Jeremy. We just go with it. And how do you see it, Jerry Hinnan, formerly of CBS Sports and the Joe Cribbs Car Wash and legendary contributor to the War Eagle Reader? Why do we care about football?
This is our drama fix. We need some kind of excitement. We need to have something harmless where we can invest ourselves and still get this sugar rush of, you know, the great things happening, of the bad things happening, of not knowing what things are going to happen. And we don't get that in our day-to-day lives. We wake up, we go to work, we go to school. But really true, thrilling, I have no idea what's going to happen sort of things, those things don't happen very often. And sports kind of gives us that little sort of injection. We get our fix through sports. But sports have that extra added dimension of being real life. Like, these are actual people. These are not actors. These are not reality show contestants. You know, and that's sports.
Okay, I like it. It makes sense. But maybe there's something on a more emotional level as well. What does Reynolds Wolf of the Weather Channel think?
My gosh, it's a religious experience. I mean, it changes. You have that first blast of cooler air in the fall. You see the leaves change, and there's something about it. It's kind of like a demarcation point in our soul. It's something that kind of, I don't know, that, man, that's a great question. That's a hell of a question. I can tell you what it means to me. There's a weird thing when it comes to Auburn football. It's like being in a time machine. When I'm in Auburn and I park the car up behind Toomer's Corner and I make the walk down towards the stadium, and usually it happens every year when I'm right near Haley Center, I hear the drum line, and there's that rush of cooler air that you have just as the approach of October comes calling. And all of a sudden, I feel like I'm a 12-year-old kid again. It's this transformative thing. It's a time machine. It takes me back to a time when mom and dad were alive, they were healthy, didn't have a care in the world. And the most important thing in the world was Bo Vincent Jackson catching a ball in a toss sweep and running uphill. And it's just, there's nothing like it. It makes you young again. I can tell you that when I'm in Jordan-Hare Stadium and I get the press pass, and right before the game you've got a window of, say, I don't know, about 5 minutes or so before the game starts, before they send you back up to the booth. And you see the band spill out onto the field, and you hear the fight song, and the goosebumps, they're unavoidable. And instantly, you feel like it's 1982. You're 12 years old. It's a fountain of youth.
A fountain of youth. Something to bring us together. And something to separate us from our rivals, our opponents, dare I say our enemies? Maybe not enemies all the time, but certainly when families are being torn apart, marriages dissolved, and, you know, trees being poisoned. So those who are not familiar with life as a fan of an SEC program might not understand. So what's it like to live part or even all of your life in that kind of an environment? Where there's you and your team, and there's the other guy and his team. And you have to live and work with those people almost every day. So let's get back to John and ask him the question we were talking about. So what was it like growing up in Georgia as an Auburn fan and having not only Alabama all over the place, but also having Georgia right there in your face? Because I used to live for 11 years outside Atlanta, and I know you have them in your face all the time.
I don't think there was nearly as many Alabama fans in Atlanta as there are now. I grew up in Tucker, which is the northeast side of Atlanta, kind of near where 285 and 85 come together. And the high school I went to isn't even a high school anymore. Henderson is that high school, and now it's a middle school. And so Tucker was our rival high school, which is at Auburn's recruited a number of good players from Tucker, including some current recruits. And I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and 1980, Georgia won the national title. Mm-hmm. And there were more Georgia fans coming out of the woodwork than you could believe. They were everywhere. And we had some neighbors who were more diehard Georgia fans, and they were really crazy for a while after that. And I also knew a number of Georgia Tech fans. I had some family that went to Georgia Tech. My grandfather and uncle and some cousins on the other side ended up going to Georgia Tech. And so I had some feelings for Georgia Tech, and I had some neighbors and friends who were Georgia Tech fans. But really, that was it. I mean, occasionally you'd meet somebody who cheered for some other team, Clemson or Florida or something, or Tennessee. But it was mostly the people that I knew were mostly Georgia or Georgia Tech or Auburn fans. Again, there weren't Alabama fandom has spread like a plague across the land in the last six or seven years as we record this.
How strange.
And I mean, even where I live now in Central Virginia, there are Alabama fans all over the place, and I often want to stop them and ask them, have you ever actually set foot on the campus, or you just like put stickers on your car? But no, at the time, my parents both went to Auburn, and they had season tickets, and we went to a lot of Auburn events, football games and other events. And so some of my earliest memories are getting in the car on Saturday and going down there and tailgating with them and their friends and going to the game. And, this was in that I can remember in the early days, and, before Dye even, there was like a area behind the concession stand under the stadium where it was like dirt, and you could get back there and just kind of hang out as like a little kid. If you didn't feel like watching the game, because it was sometimes they were fun and sometimes they weren't. But it was, I have a lot of fond memories of that as a young child, going to the tailgates and throwing a football around, or playing in the grass or whatever near Sewell Hall, and because we always tailgated in that area. But you're right about the fandom in terms of they were mostly Georgia fans. We had to deal with them. We didn't have a lot of success against them, until Dye came, and it was tough dealing with them early on.
Well, I always say there's no wrong way to have become an Auburn person. However you get there is fine. If you went to the school, that's great. If you graduated from the school, that's great. If you married into it, that's great. If you just decide the uniforms look cool, that's great. It all works. We'll take all comers. We're not picky, We're one big happy family, and we welcome everybody that's, all you got to do is just support Auburn. And in fact, Reynolds Wolf has an interesting story about how he became a member of the family.
I became an Auburn fan back around 1978 or so. And the reason why I became an Auburn fan is because my family owned horses, and I had a horse that was dying. Came home from school, got off the school bus. My mom was hysterical because one of the horses was dying. The vet looked at me, looked at mom. Dad came home from work and said, okay, we've got two options. Either we can put this horse to sleep, or we can put this horse on a trailer and we can send it to Auburn, Alabama. There's an equine center, and maybe they can pull a miracle and save this animal's life. And at the age of 8, I became an Auburn fan because of a dying horse.
So you see, we may take different paths, but we all come to the same place. We come to believe in Auburn and love it. And that's what matters. Though heaven knows, when it comes to football, it hasn't always been easy. Like you, John, my dad went to Auburn in the late 50s. He was there for the 57 as a freshman for the 57 national championship. And his senior class graduated, I think, from, was the class to first class to graduate from Auburn University rather than API. And he tells it this way.
The earliest thing I remember was when Shug Jordan was the coach, and they had a get-together in the stadium because I think they had won part of a national championship that year. That was the only thing I went to. I can remember leaving Auburn and hearing the crowd over in the stadium hollering. And I never even bought tickets. My interest in Auburn football didn't start till way after I graduated.
So yeah, it took my dad a little while to come around, but by the time I was a kid, he was getting on board, and my granddad that raised me was always a huge fan. And it was hard back in those years because that was the dreaded Barfield era. Here's Reynolds Wolf.
In 1978, this is the world of Doug Barfield. If you're an Auburn fan, the world is not good. it isn't. And being a kid growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, going to Valley Elementary School, I bet it was maybe 90-10 weighted towards Alabama fans in the school. And you just expected punishment every fall. When you got to November, the question was not, was Alabama going to win? The question was, did Auburn have a prayer of looking presentable? Could they put a decent product on the field? Could they look like they had some kind of a pulse? And more often than not, the inevitable happened, the Tide would win. And it was awful as an Auburn fan.
My dad again.
I think when we changed coaches after we got rid of the one that was so terrible.
Barfield.
I didn't even like to go in the same stadium with him. Honestly, he was terrible. After we changed coaches again, when Pat came, it just rejuvenated the whole thing. I sort of got interested then, and then I got to be a real fan. And I've been a real fan ever since, I guess. But that deal with Barfield liked to shut the whole school down, I think.
While we were on the subject of Doug Barfield, I couldn't help but ask my dad one other question, and I don't think many of you are going to like his answer.
What did you think about the orange jerseys? Did you approve or disapprove?
I approved of that.
I like
the orange jerseys, yeah.
Oh boy. I don't think he understood what a controversial topic he was stepping into there. But let's get back on topic. So, what is it about Auburn in particular that draws us to it so much?
It's not really the idea of football.
Here's Reynolds.
It's the experience. It's much more than wins and losses. It's much more than just, is Auburn going to beat Arkansas? Are they going to topple Tennessee? Are they going to beat the Tide? It's greater than that.
Jerry Hinnan.
Auburn really is a community. Now, you know, lots of colleges and universities form communities. That's kind of the part of the essential nature of attending a lot of universities in this country. But Auburn, I do think, is a tighter community, particularly for a university of its size, because of the city that it's, you know, it really is through and through a college town, start to finish. If you go to Auburn, you are in Auburn. That's why you were there. You know, it really is the hub of everything. And it's not the only one in the country, but that also does make it very different from a lot of other college experiences. And then what Auburn football does on top of that is that it keeps that community sort of reconnected. I went to Birmingham Southern for undergrad. I went to Auburn for grad school. But I grew up, you know, in Dadeville, which is about, you know, 30 minutes, 40 minutes from Auburn. The son of Auburn parents, you know, more Auburn, plenty of Auburn family members. And, you know, with Birmingham Southern, you know, made lots of friends, but I don't feel that same connection with the Birmingham Southern community on an annual basis in the fall the way you necessarily do with Auburn. Like with Auburn, it's every Saturday. We've got 80,000 people in the stadium. We've got everybody watching at home. We're talking on Twitter. We're talking on Facebook. We're going out to the grocery stores and stopping in the aisles to chat about what happens. And so it connects us as an Auburn community in a way that I'm not sure anything else does.
It really does connect us. But while I was talking with my dad, I had one more question along these same lines for him.
What is it meant living in this area on like a daily basis to be an Auburn person as opposed to an Alabama person? Like, what's the life experience like?
You're an underdog.
Yeah. Which is a lot lately. Yeah,
yeah, you're an underdog. That's about it.
While my stepmother summed it up pretty succinctly in the background there using one word that she spelled out, my dad used another word, underdog, and he's not the only person to use that word. Here's Jeremy Henderson again.
My grandparents lived in Auburn and still live in Auburn, and my dad grew up here and my parents met here and everybody went to college here. And so when I was growing up, coming down to Auburn was synonymous with going to grandmama's. And so it was always this just kind of magical place to me. And so it kind of, for me, being like an Auburn fan really just kind of stems, or, you know, an Auburn person stems so much from that. Sometimes I'm almost kind of like envious of the experience that other people have of like, okay, well, they're looking to go to a college, you know, college somewhere. They come, they fall in love with the place, yada, yada. To me, it was just like, it just always was, because I still live here. And I've essentially, say for a year in Texas, lived here since I came to school. That gets into the whole phenomenon of what makes Auburn Auburn and why it is so strange and unique, the relationship between the town and the university and how it's just so completely intertwined. I think more so in Auburn than any other team, you know, any other fan base and school I could think of in the country, really. In a certain sense, you know, you think that like Auburn's spirit is inextricably kind of tied to the spirit of the underdog. And I guess most people kind of imagine themselves, and for a variety of reasons, from the get-go, from its foundations, be it its geographical, its location, comparison to other schools that it was competing against, and the things that they had to work with, and the things Auburn was having to work against, and, you know, overcome. And so everybody wants to be, you know, for the big moment, for the big story. I mean, everybody wants to be the underdog. Nobody wants to be. I mean, to me, that's one of the reasons why it's so great to be an Auburn fan, is because, you know, especially when, you know, talking about our arch enemy, they really don't have any underdog comeback stories, at least like in our rivalry, at least that immediately like come to mind. They don't have a punt, bam, a punt. Heaven forbid they would ever consider themselves that.
Reynolds agrees.
When it comes to Alabama and Auburn, it comes to football, it's easy in this life to become an Alabama fan. The easiest thing in the world is to back success. It's simple to be a Patriots fan, to be a Yankees fan, to be a fan of the Alabama Crimson Tide. But to be an Auburn fan, it takes something a little bit different. Wins and losses matter, but there has to be something else that draws you.
So, does it take something a little extra, a little special to be an Auburn person? Let's get back to John. My family always just were Auburn fans, but we were certainly in the minority. I mean, I remember coming up through elementary school and middle school and up into high school. We Auburn fans, we Auburn family, man, we stuck together because there was just so many more Alabama fans. And they loved, they reveled in sticking it to you. And every, you know, every November, December was time to once again, because the first year we won was my freshman year of high school, 82. So from kindergarten through eighth grade, Alabama won every year. And that's tough.
And that's tough.
Yeah, it is really tough. The thing is, there's never a temptation to change sides, though. I mean, that's something I think is interesting, is that as an Auburn person, you don't get that sense of, oh, I'm just going to go cheer for somebody else now, even if we keep losing. I mean, if you can lose to your hated arch rival who's taunting you in school every day by the dozens every year for nine straight years, and it's all you know as a child is losing. I don't even remember punt, bam, a punt, which was the last win before that nine-game streak. That says a lot about the resilience of Auburn fans, and I guess college football fans in general, that we don't change sides. We're not fair-weather fans. Well, there are some, obviously, and you were just mentioning some, but, I mean, is that particular to Auburn, or is that to a lot of teams? It certainly doesn't seem to be true of Alabama.
Well, I mean, I think my opinion is that some of the people who are fans of Alabama are fans because they win, not because they've actually ever seen the school or care about the school or went there or anything.
Right.
They just like to associate themselves with somebody that wins all the time, and that doesn't require any great sacrifice or character or anything else. So I think part of being an Auburn, one of the things is I think there's a lot of really good people who are Auburn people. And I think, you know, it made for a really good environment when Auburn people got together and at games and other events and stuff. And so I really liked that. But also, I think you're right. Like, there was never a, we're going to come out tomorrow and not be Auburn fans. I mean, that's not how it works. So you just, you know, keep your head up and keep going, and things will get better. And that's how it is.
It's just part of what comes with being an Auburn person is that you realize we're in the SEC. It's tough. It was tough back then. It's tough now. And you just deal with it.
But does part of that come down to sometimes the winning doesn't feel as good as losing feels bad kind of thing?
Losing hurts more than winning feels good is what Louis Grizzard famously said. And I thought that was a very, very important statement that he made. And so ever since I heard it the first time years and years and decades ago, I've always tried to make sure that I fully appreciate and enjoy our wins and never take them for granted, and because I want them to feel at least as good as the losing hurts. Yes. And I feel like psychologically we have some control over that. Something hurts because you let it hurt, but a feeling like that. But something feels good because you stop and let it feel good. And if you just say, okay, we won, I expected that, and you just move on, you're not taking time to smell the roses and appreciate what you've got, and you're taking it for granted. And so, yeah, every time Auburn wins a game, unless it's just the most blowoutiest of blowouts against, you know, totally overmatched programs, I try to be happy for a little while. I try to revel in it and enjoy it a little bit because I know how bad I would feel if it were like Georgia and we lost, you know, or Alabama and we lost. And I think, well, I want to enjoy this just as much as I would be miserable if we'd lost.
Yes, because if your expectation is that you're going to win every contest that ever happens and you don't, mm-hmm. win all of those, then you're going to be unhappy on balance.
More often, yeah, exactly, on balance. Yeah, more often than you're happy. And what kind of, who wants that? You know, if you tie yourself to Alabama and your bare minimum is going undefeated every year and going to the playoffs and winning every year, then you could go, 12-1, and that's a disappointing season and you're bitter off season. Who wants that? I've said this before. I would rather be an Auburn person and have 2010 than be an Alabama person today with three of their titles, because I promise you they did not enjoy any of those three titles nearly as much as I enjoyed 2010 just because of everything that went into it. Well, that's how I feel about it, and here's Reynolds.
I remember Pat Dye talking about the type of player that he would recruit. He would say that the Auburn recruit always had something a little bit different about them. And the ones that they would sign had something that was a little bit deeper than just, again, the wins and losses. They fell in love with the experience of being at Auburn. They loved Auburn as a home. They loved Auburn as a center of the universe. They really did. And it stays with them. I don't think, it's easy for me to say as an Auburn fan, but I don't think Alabama fans or Georgia fans have much of the same. When I was in high school, I remember my sister dated this guy who was a huge Alabama fan, had no connection to the University of Alabama, had no connection to Tuscaloosa, had never been to the Capstone to see a game. And I remember asking him, why are you an Alabama fan? And he said, I'm a Bama fan because Alabama is the state in which I live. And as a 17-year-old, I thought that was hilarious. But as a guy who's 48, that makes a damn good bit of sense. It really does. It's common sense to be an Alabama fan. But to be an Auburn fan, it's a little bit deeper. I think it's a bit more nuanced. We don't have the same success, and we've not had the same history that they have had. And I think that we look at the wins and losses with much more gratitude, much more the wins. We see the wins with much more gratitude. It's very, very different between the fan base. Like I said, it's easy to be an Alabama fan. An Auburn fan, it takes a lot of patience. It really does. And Van, as you've said before, time and time again, that when you're an Auburn fan, this is what you get. These things happen. You have the great expectations, but it's never automatic. It's never easy to be an Auburn fan. But the thing is, I'll take it, though. I'll take it, and I accept it as an Auburn fan. I will. And I'll take the losses, and I'll take the wins. And it's great because when you do have the winning times, it carries more weight. It does matter. It resonates. At Alabama, I'm convinced that they win a title, and when they have that title, after a year passes, they throw it out like yesterday's newspaper, like yesterday's coffee grounds. But at Auburn, we'll always have 2004. We'll always have 1983. Even years that we don't win titles, those years mean something to us. We hold them. They keep us warm during the cold months. I mean, 2013, my favorite team of all time. It stays with you. And I think that with Alabama, winning is so easy, it doesn't matter as much.
I mean, if 2010 had happened after we had just won the national championship in 2009, I would not have enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed it following 1957. You know what I mean?
Yeah, amen to that.
Or 1983 and everything that happened there, and 1993 and everything that happened there, and 2004. 1988 and 2004, and all the stuff that this series is really going to be about before it's all over.
Here's Jared Albrick. He's the yard sale artist and art director here at White Rocket and one of our podcast co-hosts. He has an interesting story of how he came to be an Auburn person, and let's get that before we ask him the same question.
Well, basically, yeah, I was the son of a military man. My dad was in the Army, so we moved around a lot. And I'm originally from South Bend, Indiana. So if you've got the "what the hell is the world coming to" soundbite ready to go, I'm from South Bend. I grew up a Notre Dame fan. And then I went to high school here in Alabama. Time to go to college. I put in for all the military scholarships, got accepted by Air Force ROTC. They actually accepted me to go to Tennessee. So I was headed to Tennessee. My then girlfriend got accepted to Auburn, and she said, "Hey, come up with me to E-Day." You know, I have the E-Day at Auburn every year where high school students can come check it out. I went up there. I talked to the ROTC folks at Auburn, said, "Yeah, I've got a scholarship to Tennessee." And they said, "Well, would you rather come to Auburn?" And I said, "Sure, because I want to be with my girlfriend." And I don't know how that works in the world of government paperwork, but I never signed anything. I never did any paperwork. When I got home from that trip, I had a voicemail that said, "This is Colonel Butler, and I will be seeing you in the fall. You'll be coming here for your ROTC and your college." I thought, cool. And that worked out well because I ended up marrying that girl. We got two kids now. And that's how I became an Auburn fan. I said, okay, guess I'm going to Auburn. So it just absolutely fickle finger of fate.
But so how aware were you of Auburn football before you ended up living in Alabama? And then, and like over the course of time, how did it become more and more into your awareness?
Okay. Big thing? Yeah, that's kind of another layer to the story. I had an awareness of it because being an Army brat, we had lived here in Alabama before down at Fort Rucker. And my mom had some friends that were big Auburn people, so they're always giving me Auburn gifts. I remember getting an orange and blue Auburn digital watch and a Bo Jackson t-shirt. So I always thought Bo Jackson was cool. So I got a little influence. And this is when I was in about second or third grade. But then again, I sort of stuck with Notre Dame. And just coming into Auburn football, I went to high school here in Alabama. So, of course, I was kind of around it, but it didn't really penetrate me. It didn't want part of me. And then even when I went to Auburn, it was just sort of a college decision. The football didn't even have its hooks into me yet. In fact, I considered it, believe this or not, it's going to be considered heresy. I considered it an inconvenience. I was like, oh my gosh, it's a football day. So now it's going to be a pain in the butt to drive from one place to another and this kind of thing. My entire 4 years of going to Auburn, I went to one football game. And I did it because ROTC – I take that back, two football games. I did it because ROTC worked a food booth for one, and I went and volunteered the food booth. And we also worked the president's box. We basically are sort of like glorified hat check, coat check people at the president's box. We open the door. We welcome people. We hang up their coats, things like that. And so I did two games, one at the food, one working the president's box. And I really didn't care much about Auburn football. I graduated, moved away, started my Air Force career. Pope Air Force Base, North Carolina. I just started kind of missing Auburn. I just missed Auburn in general. And that was the way I could connect. So I'm going to start watching them play football. So I started watching Auburn football in 2000. I went to Auburn from 95 to 99, and I actually started watching it and caring about it in 2000. And from there on, it just got its hooks into me.
Well, as we've discovered earlier in this program, apparently you still went to more games as a student than my dad did, and he was there when we won the first national championship.
So. Okay, so I don't feel as bad
now. No, clearly. And this was information I didn't have until we interviewed for this show. So
I think Auburn football matters because it seems to be that one thing that just binds us all together. It binds us, penetrates us, it runs through it. Wait, that's the force. but no, in a sense, it kind of is. It is almost like the force of the Auburn family. It's kind of weird how it landed on football. I guess football being a predominantly popular American sport probably led to that. But I could see it in any alternate dimension being any other sporting event or something like that that just kind of brings everyone together. You got a stadium full of 84,000, 85,000. How many does it seat, Van? 85, 86?
It's up over that now.
Is it? Yeah. 85, 87. Lots of 1,000 people. Yeah. 87,000 people. And it's just that is the beacon of home. That's where you go to. You have your highest of highs, your lowest of lows. It's emotionally wrapped up into it. That's where you meet your friends. That's where you go for the cookout. Especially in the fall where the weather in a great state of Alabama is finally breaking and becoming halfway decent. So you actually want to get together. We don't get together for summer sports. But I would say, yeah, that it really just is. It could be any sport in any timeline. But I think because of United States football so popular, it's sort of the most popular sport there. Mm-hmm. And then it, like I said, it just becomes that home base where we all go to meet and experience the highs and experience unfortunate lows from time to time. But most of the time you get to spend time with your friends, so isn't that really the ultimate high?
And what does it, Matt, what does it mean to that you have Alabama across the state who have kind of chosen that as their form of their ultimate expression, you know, of their worthiness? And or is there a little bit of us trying to compete on what they see as their battlefield, their playing field, and say it's not just yours, it's ours too? I mean, is having a big rival part of that?
What's this other team you're talking about? I'm not sure I know. I'm sure that plays into it. I would say it's been my experience that more so the football identity has mattered even more so to that fan base. The Alabama fan base, I think, is even tighter to it. I know Auburn people who support Auburn swimming and diving. I know Auburn people who support Auburn, you know, equestrian, baseball, soccer, you name it, softball. We enjoy our lady softball team especially. And I think we have a broader range of that, but I think you're right. I think because our rivals are so focused on it, that's sort of our natural line of communication.
Here's Reynolds.
I was in television, started in television about 25 years ago. So that puts it around 1993, 1994. And I was in Anniston, Alabama. And I left my job in Anniston, Alabama to go to San Luis Obispo, California. I went to San Luis Obispo, California, and let's see, my gosh, this was on the day after Christmas in 1993. And back in 93, the internet was in its infancy. And I went from one side of the country to the other. And when I left Alabama, I was essentially leaving Auburn football. So I was moving to a place where I had no money. I couldn't afford cable television. And out on the West Coast, if I tuned into anything, I was watching Pac-10 football. So I lost all of what Auburn was to me. It was like having part of my soul amputated. But I can tell you, being without Auburn football and driving down to Los Angeles one day and walking through Hollywood and seeing someone walk up the street wearing an Auburn T-shirt, I almost burst into tears. It was like seeing someone from your home planet and you've been living on Mars. It was the greatest, most comforting thing in the whole world. And there was like this great connection. It made me appreciate, made me realize just how special this being part or loving Auburn happens to be.
Jerry Hinnan.
Like, you've got Tim Cook, and it's awesome that, you know, an Auburn grad is in charge of the first $1 trillion business in the world. But at the same time, we don't get that same connection through those kinds of successes. Like, our aerospace engineering program is so great. It's fantastic. But we're not going to stop in the grocery store aisles to talk about it. And so I think that's why Auburn football matters, is it's this connective tissue that it wouldn't be necessary to bring us all together in the first place as an Auburn community. But it is necessary every fall that we get those bonds re-strengthened that we have the connective tissue sort of reforged, so to speak. And when you tie in, you know, not just the people who we went to Auburn with, but again, our families, our friends, sort of the larger community out from there, it's the sort of thing that once you are connected to it, it's not likely, I think, that you're ever not going to be connected to it.
The Auburn Football Review. To you by South Central Bell, featuring Coach Ralph Shugarton with Carl Stephens.
Were you able to appropriately despise Alabama,
John,
being that removed from them, say, compared to me? I'm not saying my experience was better, worse, anything other than yours. I just know that I had them in my face all the time. So what was it like for you related to Alabama, not being in the middle of it as much?
It was definitely different because, again, this is pre-games in the home stadium.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, and we, my parents did not, you know, had season tickets for Auburn. We did not go to Legion Field. So we did not go to those games when I was a kid. And so, like, I came into contact with Alabama fans. We knew some. But I'm sure it wasn't a tenth of the level of stuff that you got. And I got, you know, I got stuff at school or whatever from other people in Alabama won, but it was more because, like, they knew I was an Auburn fan and we lost and it was a chance to give me crud or whatever.
Yeah.
Some of them weren't, these people weren't diehard Alabama fans. They just wanted a chance to mess with me. So,
can I just, I've never understood the third person fan experience, which is, I'm a fan of Team A, you're a fan of Team B. I know that you and Team C hate each other, so when Team C beats you, I'm going to use Team C's battle cry and taunt you. What is that?
People who need more to do. I don't
that,
know.
It's like the Oregon fans in Arizona that yelled RT at us. Like, that's not your battle cry. Quack at us or something. Don't pick some other random team. And it's just bizarre. I've never understood that. I never have. I would never go up to like a Florida fan and do the tomahawk chop at him. Why? It just makes sense. I would never go up to a Tennessee fan and like wave an encyclopedia like I was a Vanderbilt fan. So I don't understand these things, John. I don't get them. Here's Jeremy Henderson.
As far as the 70s, that was this like dirty word growing up for me. It was like this wilderness or something that, like, you didn't talk about, nobody wanted to talk about. And that, you know, that our fathers wandered through searching for water, for food, for the Lord. You know, he had abandoned us, is the way I grew up kind of like thinking of that time period. And as I've gotten older and I've gone back and I've researched and studied and kind of like love the 70s now for a variety of reasons. But the early 70s, I mean, we were pretty dang good. The 74 team was actually like a really, really good team and totally should have beaten Bama. And would have, and pretty much kind of got robbed. And then, you know, other than the Florida game, Florida was the really only team that beat us that year. And we wound up stomping Texas in the Gator Bowl. So that's always got to be good. You know, and then Barfield had like a, you know, a decent year or two, and I think came close. And I've interviewed him a time or two. And it's interesting to hear his thoughts. I mean, having to be the man after the man, nobody wants to be that guy. And it just didn't work out for him for a variety of reasons. But yeah, I mean, my dad, I mean, it was hard to kind of, if for somebody growing up in the 80s, and that being my first experience, and I don't know if you want to do this now, but for that being my first taste of it, from going from essentially, like, in my mind, Auburn losing once in a blue moon to this imagining what it was like for my dad, it didn't make any sense.
Atkins and Robbins move wide left, Franklin wide right on second down, 17 at the 49. Cribbs and Brooks split behind Trotman. He fakes inside. Give to Cribbs at the 45-40. He's at the 35-30, 25-20, and knocked down at the 20-yard line on a shoestring tackle. Pat Collins, I think, came up to knock it down. Pat Collins, a rover, just got Joe Cribbs on a shoestring tackle. He just exploded for 30 yards down to the 20-yard line. Second down, 10. Auburn up at the 34-yard line. Bird and Robbins wide left. Franklin wide right. Chester Willis is in, replacing Cribbs at the fullback spot. They fake it inside. Trotman keeps on the option. He pitches to Brooks at the 35-40. 45-50. Brooks at the 45-40. He's at the 35. He may go all the way. 25-20. 50. 10. 5. Touchdown. What a run by James Brooks.
When did you first go? Do you remember your first trip to an Auburn game in Auburn?
Honestly, I don't. I'm sure I went before I can remember it, but I know I was at games in the early 70s. So
I never really had the opportunity much to go. My parents didn't really go, and nobody I hung out with went. And so I remember the first game I went to must have been, I think it might have been Georgia Tech in 1978, if we played Georgia Tech in Auburn in 1978. That seems right. And I think it was 78 because I know it was Barfield, but I think it was that year because I remember going in the Auburn University bookstore in Haley Center, and I remember they had the big Star Wars Treasury comic book edition on the magazine rack, and I bought it. And that was like one of my treasured belongings for many years, too, because I got it at Auburn. I put Auburn stickers all over the front of my Star Wars comic book. That's kind of funny. But I think we lost. I feel like we lost to Georgia Tech. And then I remember going the next year, and I think it was the game against Mississippi State where we won where we wore the orange jerseys. Because I know I went to an orange jersey game. It must have been 79 against Mississippi State. And I don't think I went again until 1985 Mississippi State, because I remember seeing Bo play one time, and it was that Mississippi State game the year he won the Heisman Trophy, his senior year, because I remember it was 21-9. The reason I know the score was 21-9 Auburn is because in the first half, I think Bo scored three touchdowns. We were in one end zone, and he scored all three at the other end zone in the first half. And in the second half, Mississippi State kicked three field goals at the other end. So all 30 points were scored at the far end of the field from where we were. I remember that very clearly. So that was the last time I actually went to an Auburn game until I was a freshman in 86, 87. So I wasn't there all that much, but and they weren't on TV all that much. But what it did, I sure listened to Jim Fife on the radio a lot. I'm sure you had stations too and were able to listen back then, right?
Oh, yeah. The Auburn Radio Network was in Atlanta, and we could listen. And again, people today, it's probably mind-bending to think, like, Auburn was probably on TV, like, three times a season.
Yeah.
And so the other games you had to listen on the radio. And so we did some of that. We watched games. At some point in the 80s, we got a VCR. We would record the games too. So we had like a bunch of VHS tapes with Auburn games on them. But no, I mean, I went to, my parents had season tickets, and we went in the 70s and the 80s until I was a student. I was a freshman in the fall of 87. And I went to a lot of the games in the early and mid 80s. There were some weeks when I was, you know, busy doing other stuff and didn't get to go, but I can remember going to plenty of those games. And then I went to every game, every home game when I was a student. That's again, three SEC titles while we were students, which, you know, clearly there was something going on there. And then, been back to some games when I could after that. So
yeah we were there at the right time for sure. And then when I went back and got my master's, finished my master's, there was the 20 game win streak, so I got to enjoy that too as a sort of a second helping. I felt greedy getting to enjoy that, but I did. Let's go back and talk a little bit about what it was like in those earliest days. The game that I can still remember the most egregious, that wasn't even picked up by any television channel at all, was the 1984 Florida State game in Tallahassee. It's hard to fathom the idea that Auburn versus Florida State was not even considered a game worth picking up for any television broadcast as recently as 1984.
Florida State was a women's college for a long time. So they don't have a football history going back, you know, 100 years.
No.
They're very nouveau in that category. So But you're right. Like the idea that today that Auburn and Florida State played this big game and were not – there was no TV at all. You had no chance to see any of it is crazy.
Yeah, there's a videotape of it, and I have it, and it's probably on YouTube like everything else at this point. But that was like the closed circuit video. That was not any network broadcast, and they have the Jim Fife audio. And by the way, I listened to that game live on the radio with Jim Fife, and it was one of the greatest – he was masterful.
Auburn trailing by five. Washington looking, throwing. This one's complete inside the 20 and out of bounds at the Florida State 14-yard line. Washington hitting tight end Jeff Parks, driven out of bounds by Mike Hayes. That'll be another Tiger first down. Can it come down to this? Can you stand a finish like this? What an exciting finish it's been. A pitch to Fullwood, got a block on the outside. Brent turns the corner to the 10, broke a tackle to the 5, goes out of bounds at the 5-yard line of Florida State. With 1:13 to play, 41-36, the Tigers trail Florida State. Two tight ends for Washington. He's going to pitch to Fullwood, tries to get outside. He dives for the pylon. He's in! He's in! He's in! Touchdown, Auburn! Touchdown, Auburn! Touchdown, Fullwood from 4 yards away! And the Tigers have done it. They've marched literally the length of the field and gone ahead 42-41.
That was absolutely an amazing, masterful job. I mean, I can still remember, you know, some of his greatest work was on that one game at Tallahassee where he's, you know, Auburn gets the ball back trailing by like 6 with a minute to go or something. And he says, here they go. They're back to the wall. Their feet to the fire because they were all up against their own goal line and went 99 yards for the touchdown, you know, with a few seconds to go. So it was just amazing to because he could paint a picture with words like that. So. And we'll talk more about Fife and Rod as we go along. So like I said, I want to look back at that time. What memories do you have of the Doug Barfield era as it leads us up to Pat Dye? I mean, you know, you may even remember Shug. I don't remember Shug much at all. He was sort of trailing off in health in his last couple of years, as far as I can remember. And I know the team wasn't doing that great. His last year we went 4-6-1, and in fact, we would have been 3-6-2 if not for Mississippi State having to forfeit a game that we tied with them. So 3 wins in his final year is pretty depressing.
I do not have any direct memories of that time.
That time, right. So Barfield came in 76, and we had 5 years of the Doug Barfield era. And it was, you know, his first year was 4-7, not exactly promising. And then in 76, in 1977, 6-5-1. In 1978, 6-4-1. So he was not off to a roaring start. And I can remember that he could put together a pretty good offense, but the defense just seemed very weak back then. And we would lose a game to like a Wake Forest 45-41 or something, you know.
Yes, yes. It was a time of option football.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was very little passing back then. Our defense wasn't very good on a routine basis. So we gave up a lot of points. And we'd score points. You're right. We moved the ball and score points. We had some talented players.
Yes, we did. Well, tell the folks, who did we have on offense that still resonates? Let's ask Al Michaels.
Their quarterback wears number 6, Charlie Trotman.
He's not very big, but he's a great quarterback in a lot of ways because they run the option well. He's a good leader and very solid performer, good passer, 52% on the passing side of it, and he's just an excellent young player.
Here he finds number 82, Byron Franklin, one wide receiver, along with number 45, Rusty Bird, the speed merchants who Trotman will look to if the Auburn running game bogs down.
I don't think there's anybody in the country that can have the receivers that have the speed that Auburn does. Both of them are excellent performers, and Rusty Bird's a 4-5 young man, the 40-yard dash, and that's good anywhere.
So Trotman has been on the beam in his first two games, and certainly one of the most underrated backs as far as we are concerned in all the country would be this fella. Number 21, James Brooks, returning a kick here. He may not be a household name outside of Alabama right now, but that may change in a month or so.
Certainly will. Last year he was the freshman of the year in the Southeastern Conference, and he really got the position because of an injury to another running back that we'll see in just a minute. He's making his presence known. He's third in all total purpose running in the country right now with 205 yards. He's very powerful, and he's a runner. You can see right there.
And he's young also. James Brooks is only a sophomore and a fellow who might wind up in the top 10 in overall rushing before the year is out.
Joe Cribbs, his running mate number 20, has been injured so far this season, hasn't seen much action, but certainly could play a key part today.
Well, last year is the number three rusher in the Southeastern Conference, and of course, he's about 90% strong, and he's back, and they're glad to have him. They've got a tremendous backfield with Cribbs healthy and Brooks healthy.
And another man who should be healthy today, who has been hurt, and Auburn has certainly had its share of injuries, would be the man who normally is the blocking back. But here he takes the ball, and you can see what he can do if he finds any daylight whatsoever. William Andrews. So Auburn seems to have enough offensive punch.
Well, I mean, we had an offense at one point with James Brooks, Joe Cribbs, and William Andrews.
Yeah, amazing.
Who all went on to be starting NFL running backs, and for a while all were the leading rushers, historical rushers for their NFL teams. Mm-hmm. I mean, Brooks for the Bengals and Cribbs for the Bills and William Andrews for the Falcons. William Andrews was a fullback at Auburn, mm-hmm. but became the main running back for the Falcons in the early 80s. So, you know, and it's amazing to think like we had three NFL running backs on the team, and those were, you just listed the records.
Yeah. Yeah. The only records that were really good. Well, the only year that really was good was 1979, and when I say really good, 8-3. 1979, we went 8-3. Of course, we lost to Alabama. That was one of their national championship years. That was probably their most definitive national championship year in that era. It wasn't split like 78. 79, we were 8-3. That was the year we wore orange jerseys against Mississippi State and got a win. So that was our first win in orange jerseys. Yay. We tied a Georgia team that was pretty good in 78 in orange jerseys. That was cool. 6-4-1. But you think going out of 79 into 80, you're like, okay, so you know, we should be great this year. And we went 5-6, 0-6 in the SEC in 1980. We wore orange jerseys twice, a win over Southern Miss and a big blowout loss to Georgia. And at the end of 1980, Doug Barfield was 0-5 against Alabama, albeit very good Alabama teams, 29-25-1 overall, and he was handed his walking papers and ended up, I think, as the Opelika High School coach. And I'll never forget, Louis Grizzard, there he is again, wrote a column called Doug Barfield, where he was talking about how unfair and mean old bad old Auburn was to fire Doug Barfield after 1980. With a record of 29-25-1. And all I can figure is that 1978 tie notwithstanding, Grizzard, the big Georgia fan, wanted Barfield to be Auburn's coach for as long as they could have him, right?
But it was a different era. Fans, college coaches, unless they were terrible or were doing something terrible, they were supposed to be institutions and be there for 20 years. And that was kind of the expectation.
So in a way, Barfield was kind of like the first time Auburn began our tradition of having the quick trigger finger.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny that we get accused of that when you realize Alabama has had way more coaches than we have in that time.
That's right.
And yet you never hear anybody say Alabama's, you know, oh, they got that quick trigger finger over there in Alabama at the capstone. But after Barfield, we had Pat Dye for 12 years. We had Terry Bowden through the mid-90s. We still don't agree over how that ended. We had Tuberville for another decade, and then Chizik and Gus. That's it. That's it. Going all the way back to 1976. So, I mean, I just can't quite see how we have this reputation of having the quick trigger finger when we've had like a handful of coaches going all the way back to the mid-70s.
It's perception, but it's also caused by, like, even when we don't fire them, we may not always be happy with them.
Yeah, we do a lot of waving the gun around whether we pull the trigger or not, I guess. And that's what they're thinking about. So.
That's a good analogy.
So what at all do you remember about those 1970s up through 1980 years and Barfield and being an Auburn fan during that time?
I remember we went to the games. Auburn fans were there, but I don't think there was a lot of confidence. And I think, you know, everybody had a good time, but it wasn't, everybody enjoyed being there. We wanted to beat our rivals and that kind of stuff. But, you know, there wasn't a lot of, I guess, hope that we were going to conquer the mountain. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm trying to think back for myself. I feel like my mindset back then, there's a thing called the Auburn mindset that Shug Jordan used to talk about, but I feel like my Auburn mindset back then was, man, I sure am tired of Alabama winning all the time. And I remember thinking, gosh, I hope we have a winning season. And it would be awesome if we could beat Alabama this year. Maybe this is the year. Maybe this is the year we'll beat Alabama, but probably not.
Yes.
You know, you'd always, hope springs eternal. Every November, you'd be thinking, well, maybe this is the one. Maybe this is the one. And then I remember thinking, maybe we'll go to a bowl game. Because we could have, like I said, I think we could have gone in, we could have gone in 79, but I think on I think 79 and 80, we were on probation. And let me just tell you, if you get on probation after consecutive seasons of 4-7, 4-6-1, 4-7, 6-5, and 6-4-1, whatever you did to get on probation, you needed to do more of it, not less, because it didn't work.
It was not the Hugh Freeze full implementation strategy.
No.
Say that.
I'm just trying to figure out what investigator looked at Auburn in 75, 76, 77, 78. What investigator looked at that team and said, I need to investigate them? Clearly, there's something shady going on. I mean, wouldn't most investigators look at those seasons and say, oh, those boys are toeing the line. They're honest to a fault down there. There's nothing shady going on there. Wow. I mean, in fact, the NCAA probably would call up that 76-77 team and call up Shug and, or call up Barfield and go, you know, coach, if you need to cheat a little bit, we could look the other way. we could look the other way this one time. I mean, come on, man. This is embarrassing. But, gosh, we got on probation for doing crappy. I always say, if you're going to cheat, at least win, right? At least get something out of it. Even if they take it away later, you still had that feeling. The feeling they took away from us was 4-7, John. Yeah. Well, so 29-25-1 in Barfield is gone. And do you remember what the buzz was right after Barfield was let go on the plains? You probably remember it better than I do because I was just seeing it on, like, Birmingham local television. Who were they talking about getting?
Vince Dooley?
Yes. Oh, man.
Because he was an Auburn alum.
Yep.
And he had won the national title. I think if they had not won the national title at Georgia, you know, so close before that, I think we might have hired him.
I think so. Yeah, I think there was just no way he could leave Georgia after 1980.
And Herschel was still
there. And Herschel was still there. That would be insane. So. That's like if Pat Dye had left Auburn in 1983 to go to, like, Florida and left Bo and Lionel and all that and that defense. But I was going to say, hadn't Johnny Majors just left Pitt after a national championship to go to Tennessee?
Yeah, pretty soon after.
I feel like there was a precedent for it. So even though we're sitting here saying, you know, he couldn't have left Georgia after the, you know, right after the national championship, I think it was really as much Herschel as it was the national championship, because Johnny Majors had just done it, I think like 76 or something. And so I think Auburn people were looking at what Johnny Majors had done and said, hey, if he would leave a national championship to come to his SEC school, his alma mater or whatever, then maybe Vince would do the same thing. And they tried, didn't they? They tried to get him.
Oh, yes.
But ultimately he stayed, and we looked around. And what did you think when that new name emerged? Do you remember thinking anything about it? I mean, I have vague memories.
I wasn't exactly doing flight tracking back then or anything. So
you weren't looking at the tail number on the airplane?
No, I wasn't. So we're joking about that. They probably didn't even do planes back then. They just drove around and met at some coffee shop. So,
well, it'd be somewhere between here and Wyoming, I guess.
That's it. So, no, I mean, I didn't have any feeling when I heard we hired the Wyoming coach. I was like, well, I hope he's better. That was kind of my feeling.
Yeah.
And I'm confident that with the support of the Auburn people, the alumni, the former players, the student body, the faculty, administration, that we will be able to bring this great football tradition back to what it once was.
Well, I mean, the first thing we really heard about him, he'd been at East Carolina and for a couple of years, and he went to Wyoming. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound good. But then you find out, oh, he is one of Bear's boys, right? There's two things we found out about him with his roots. One is he was a tough, hard-nosed assistant for Bear. And now you kind of go, well, I don't approve of this Bear thing, you know. But, you know, clearly Bear can coach, even if we despise him. And if, you know, if Dye learned something from him there, that's good. And then the second thing we learned about him is he had been a Georgia Bulldog, an offensive lineman of all things. And so he had that pedigree. You know, it wasn't a head coaching pedigree. His head coaching resume was pretty thin, really. But he had that background. He was an old country boy from Georgia. He played at Georgia. He was an All-American player. And then he went and, you know, the story came out that he'd been in, I think, the Army. And when he got out of the Army, he like called up Bear Bryant and asked for a job. And Bear said, be in my office at like 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. And so Dye shows up in his Army uniform, I think. You know, it's like his dress Army uniform at Bear's office at 5 o'clock in the morning. And like Bear's already there like, what took you so long? You're late, you know. And so he got the job and worked his way up. There's always, you know, there's always these fun stories about how these coaches start out their careers, you know, just doing anything. You know, you remember Tuberville had like a trailer and was working frying fish in a fish restaurant or something while he was, you know, there's always these fun stories about that. But so Dye came in, and do you remember what he said at his interview that really sold people on him as far as like they said, how long will it take you to beat Alabama?
He said 60 minutes.
Yep. It actually took him 120 minutes, but that's quibbling, right? Because we lost the first time, but it was a tough game in 81. But
the spirit of the answer was right.
Absolutely.
You know, the spirit of the answer was, I need a 5-year plan. It's let me get on the field with them and I will beat them.
Yeah. Yeah. What he was saying was you play football for, he was big on saying you play football for 60 minutes. So rather than saying it's going to take me this many years to build a program up to that level, he said if my guys will play the best of their abilities for 60 minutes of football, we could beat them. And that was true. It didn't hurt having the greatest athlete in history as a freshman running back either, but you know, that's fine. So that first season with Dye, we go 5-6. And I remember my granddad saying, well, he had the same record as the guy we just fired. So granddaddy wasn't as patient, okay? But we did win a couple of SEC games. And the ones they lost were impressive. I remember that we went up to Tennessee, right? I mean, okay, we had another one of these stupid Wake Forest games. In fact, I want to say this was one of the first night games. Was that Wake Forest game on September 19th that we lost by 3. But then we went up to Neyland Stadium to play Tennessee, and we, you know, that was a team we had struggled with the last few years. And in front of 92,612 people, Auburn came within 3 points of knocking off Tennessee. And that's the game where Pat Dye in the locker room, the players were kind of crying and everything. And that's what he famously said, there's going to be more days like this, you know, but you got to get up and do it again and again and again. That's that famous speech that he gave that really got him motivated.
There's going to be a lot of days when you lay your guts on the line and you come away empty-handed. Ain't a damn thing you can do about it but go back and lay them on the line again and again and again. Every coach, manager, glad to be associated with you. You'll keep fighting like you did today. You'll keep playing like yet. You can build a foundation that we can live a long, long time on it all.
The next week,
he said, "We got to put it on the line."
Yeah.
And you got to do it again and again and again.
Right. And you're not always going to win, but that's all right. You just get up and you do it again. That's right. And it was really motivating, very inspirational. And then the next week we went to Lincoln, Nebraska and played Nebraska, who was a year away from being the team of the century, and lost 17-3. And that's not bad.
Nope.
In fact, I think the story was the Nebraska fans applauded Auburn when they left the field. And this was before Bo, too. There was no Bo on this team. This was just a scrappy, you know, first year under Pat Dye, only his fourth game as head coach. And we went and lost by 3 at Tennessee and lost by 14 at Lincoln, Nebraska. And you could tell something was changing. The tide was turning a little bit. We'd gone to the wishbone. What did you think about that, right? We've been using all kind of offensive sets and formations under Barfield. Dye comes in there and puts in the wishbone when it was still kind of the cutting edge thing. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah, that was exciting. I mean, it was different and it was fun. Football wasn't the same back then. Drives were much longer,
slower. Yeah,
slower. There wasn't many explosive chunk kind of plays, and it was, you know, more running. But the wishbone seemed to generate big plays on offense and keep the other team off balance and allow you to keep the ball away from them. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was great, and we had good players for it, and, you know, it was fun to watch the quarterback in it, and it was fun to watch the running backs in it. So I enjoyed the wishbone when we started putting it in. I thought it was really entertaining to watch.
Particularly when we found the quarterback that could run it so smoothly in Randy Campbell in 82. 81, we were still feeling around for a quarterback. And I don't even remember who our main quarterback was in 81. You know, we had several there in the late 70s, early 80s that were mostly running quarterbacks, and their names just elude me at the moment. I used to know them. But after that loss at Nebraska, we had LSU at home and beat them 19-7, and it's like that was really the first big win. It was only the second win for Pat Dye. But it was the first big win where it looked like we really were turning things around. And then the next week, we go to Georgia Tech to Grant Field and beat them 31-7. So you had to feel like suddenly, even though we ended up 5-6, it's very
similar. There was some momentum.
Yeah, it's very similar to Tuberville's first year, where we went 5-6 under him the first year, too, in 99. But you could feel like things were changing. There was a different sense to it all. I like that Pat Dye always would say, and his players would say, he talked about wolf sign. We talked about this in one of our columns one time, that he would say there's wolf sign, like after a practice. Because, mm-hmm. you know, some of our best players in 81, they say that the toughest practice they ever had, college or pro, was that first year, 81, under Pat Dye. Because our big defensive lineman that went to the Steelers later. He said he just wanted a T-shirt that said, "I survived the 1981 Auburn spring practice," you know, or whatever, because he said Pat Dye tried to kill us, basically. And he drove off some guys, but the ones that stayed, you know, it's kind of like Bear Bryant with the Junction Boys, you know. The ones that stay are have been through fire, you know. And he would talk about wolf sign, like blood and fur and bits of skin lying around on the ground, and it looks like everything's torn up. And that's what... that's what practice looked like, blood and fur lying around, and, you know, things had been torn up a lot. So I think Pat Dye pretty much laid down the sense that things were changing and changing pretty rapidly, and certainly 82 would be a different year. You know, we go on to lose by 11 to Georgia. We did beat Florida at home. That's awesome. On Halloween, we played Florida on Halloween a lot. Georgia was number 4. We lost by 11 to them in Athens. And then we came back 2 weeks later, because there used to be a two-week break between Georgia and Alabama, an off week. And Alabama at this point was number 4. So we played the number 4 team 2 weeks, 2 games in a row. This is when it was still in Legion Field every week. And I remember that we led them 17-16 late in the game. Because I remember thinking, oh, 17-16. The last time we beat them, you know, 8 years ago at that point, it was 17-16. And we had them 17-16. And then they ended up scoring a couple of times, going for two and missing it or whatever. And the final score was 28-17, Alabama, because they just had more depth. And as Dye would say, they played for 60 minutes. And that was also, do you remember what 81 also was as far as the Iron Bowl is concerned? We relate to the Bear. It was his 315th win, which was important because Amos Alonzo Stagg won 314, and it was when it was when Bear became the winningest Division I coach in history for a while.
And that's right.
And it was supposed to come a couple of weeks earlier, and I remember they lost maybe to LSU, and they tied Southern Miss or somebody. And I remember when those things happened, I remember thinking, oh, no, that means it's getting bumped down closer and closer, and then, yep, it was going to be us. And they made a huge production out of it, you know, oh, this is Bear's coronation as the king of all college football, beating us was just like the cherry on top for them. So anyway, that would be the end of Pat Dye's first year. And as Auburn fans, we were, you know, 5-6. We weren't thrilled, but you had to feel like things were getting better, right?
Yeah, and then he was bringing in toughness. The defense was getting better. And there was just, you know, the new offense. There was some hope on the horizon that we were closing the gap with people for sure.
Yeah. So you and I, at this point, in the beginning of the 80s, we're still in our hometowns in grade school. But even then, we probably knew that one of these days we would be down there. And I don't know if we could have ever guessed that by the time we got there, Auburn would be winning, beating Alabama 4 years in a row, 86 through 89, playing Alabama in Auburn for the first time ever, and winning three SEC championships in a row.
Nope.
So you can see why Pat Dye became so beloved so quickly. I mean, for those of you that maybe don't know, that weren't old enough or don't remember or whatever, in this last segment, John and I pretty much spelled out what it was like to be an Auburn fan before Pat Dye. So now we're looking at how it changed. And in our next installment, we will look at the experience of being an Auburn fan in the Pat Dye early years when things were getting better and better. We had Bo, we had Lionel James, and then Brent Fullwood. We had a defense that was world class. After so many years of having a sieve for a defense, we suddenly completely flipped that. And for many years, that was the one thing you could depend on after that, was that Auburn, used to you could depend on Auburn having a bad defense. Pat Dye is the one that made Auburn and defense synonymous for so very long.
Yes.
And so it made all the difference. So any final thoughts as far as up through 81 and what it was like as an Auburn fan and what it felt like going forward?
But there was untapped potential, but it was hard to see it, I guess. But also that there wasn't a lot of huge wins and, you know, great seasons in there, but we still enjoyed them, and we enjoyed the wins when they came, and we look forward to brighter days ahead.
Oh, and indeed things were changing, and it would not be long at all before we would be hearing those famous words, courtesy of Jim Fife.
Nobody split. Give the ball up and over, and in, I believe, touchdown! Touchdown, Auburn!
We Believed is a production of the AU Wishbone and White Rocket Entertainment in association with theWarEagleReader.com. I'm Reynolds Wolf. The show was produced and engineered by Van Allen Plexico and John Ringer and brought to you by all of our great supporters on Patreon.com. To join the AU Wishbone family, visit AUWishbone.com. War Eagle.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
This is Van one more time. I want to thank everyone who made this show and the rest of this series possible. That includes not just the fine folks who consented to be interviewed for it, but also our patrons via Patreon.com. You folks are the reason we're able to do shows like this, and as a reward for your support, this show is being made available to you earlier than anyone else. If you'd like to join the crowd, join our family, and make shows like this, as well as our regular Wishbone series possible, just go to www.auwishbone.com. The patrons as of this recording include Brendan O'Dwyer, Christopher Burleson, Joseph Fine, Brandon Sisson, Phil Amthor, Susan Trawick, Ben Spooner, Stephen Thompson, Chris Usher, Justin Bean, Steve Trawick, Richard Stevens, Joshua Corbett, Valiant Hermes, Jacob and Robin Fleming, Clay Henson, Auburn Tiger Talk, Ann Kangian, Catherine England, George Gaston, Will Summerford, John McCune, Tom Anderson, David Evers, Andrew Barber, Timothy, Steve Harlan, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, Rich Reimer, Jared Albrick, William Glenn Matthews, Joel Beckham, David Hegler, Mickey B., Hugh Anderson, Shane Bailey, Matt Robbenheimer, Mick Vigicana, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, Tony Perry, Alex Nguyen, Josh Teal, David Simpson, Earl Ricks, Mike Finley, C.T. Wayne, Michael Kirster, Dave Powell, Ronald McCullum, Chris Camo, Darren Pyle, Chris, Wardam Wade, Jason Albrick, Randall Walker, Ben Amos, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Patrick Williams, Rob Morgan, Steven Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Raines, Nicholas Craig, Russell Milling, Matthew Wagstaff, Joey Miller, Mark Squire, Dave Medina, Spanky, Brant Rumble, J.W. Rice, Michael Morton, Lawrence McCain, plus our one-time donors, including Surfer Chickify and our others, including the anonymous donors. We thank all of you, and again, if you want to join that group and be called out in person every episode and thanked, as well as receiving benefits like getting to hear these shows early, just go to www.auwishbone.com and click Become a Patron. Thanks, and War Eagle, and we'll see you next episode.